Members, Senator Gazelka is going to join us in the full committee. When we organized, we ended up with members on the Reform Division that weren't on the full committee. They were valued good members of that division, and he wants to be part of the discussion. So he's joining us, and will be participating in the discussion, but not voting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxon. We have a quorum. Senate File 1026.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 1026, as you referred to. This bill converts property tax exemption for pollution control equipment to a state tax credit. This will provide property tax relief to other taxpayers in the area of the utilities, the host taxpayers. I have with me today Bradley Peterson, representing the Coalition of Utility Cities, and Marshall Halleck, Finance Director for the City of Red Wing, to explain the bill further. I believe we have an amendment.
Yep, the A3.
Oh, yeah. We have an amendment. I move an amendment.
Can we get the amendment passed out? What's the amendment do, Senator Saxon?
I'm going to ask Bradley to explain that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Bradley Peterson with the firm of Flaherty and Hood, here on behalf of the Coalition of Utility Cities. And the amendment takes care of three things, really. First, it provides some language that was requested by Great River Energy, as they have a sort of separate agreement with their local unit of government in Elk River. And so it provides some language that they had requested. The second piece of this, starting at line 1.23, basically was worked out with the Department of Revenue a while ago and provides a reference so that as the department is calculating what the exemption would have been, they know what to refer back to. And then the third portion of this, and I'll discuss this more in my testimony, starting at line 2.6, makes the credit a refundable tax credit.
Thank you. And is this your first committee stop, Senator? So this is
yes.
An author's amendment.
Yes.
Senator Dietzick moves the A3 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Saxon.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, with me today is Bradley Peterson, who you just heard from, and Marshall Halleck, Finance Director, City of Red Wing. I'm going to ask them both to give some testimony.
Who would you like first, Senator?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have actually two handouts that if we could get distributed for the committee, that would be...
page and welcome to the committee.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Bradley Peterson with the firm of Flaherty and Hood, here on behalf of the Coalition of Utility Cities, consisting of the cities of Becker, Cohasset, Granite Falls, Hoyt Lakes, Monticello, and Red Wing, all communities that host large power plants. First, I'd like to thank Senator Saxon for his authorship of Senate File 1026 and for the committee for taking the time this morning to hear this bill. As Senator Saxon indicated, the topic of this legislation is an exemption in state law for pollution control equipment. And so a little bit of background. The exemption was originally put into law in the late 1960s before things like the Clean Air Act were in place, and it acted as an incentive to install pollution control equipment. The current language contained in Minnesota Statutes 272.02 exempts property that is, quote, used primarily for the abatement and control of air, water, and land pollution to the extent that it is so used. And there are a number of industries that are covered under that. The utility makes its application to the Department of Revenue, which sends it over to MPCA for a technical review. MPCA compares the application to its current permit. If the equipment is required under the permit, the equipment is deemed to be tax exempt, and then the Department of Revenue issues the exemption. Because of the fact that an exemption is tied to the regulatory permit, I think it's questionable that at this point in our history, the exemption serves any incentivizing purpose in terms of installing the equipment. There, as the revenue note for the bill shows, there's an approximately $800 million worth of value, utility property that is exempt from property taxes. As Mr. Halleck from the City of Red Wing will explain in a moment, the values of the plants and the property taxes derived from them have been highly variable and very volatile over the last 20 years. From our group's perspective, if the installation of pollution control equipment is a state priority to incent, even though the installation of the equipment is required by a permit, then perhaps the state ought to have the burden of providing the tax preference. So what Senator Saxhog bill does with the amendment that was just added is convert the pollution control exemption from an exemption from property taxes to a refundable credit against the utility state tax liability. In drafting this, it has been our intent to avoid increasing the utility's tax liability, but rather to shift the source of the tax preference off of the local property taxpayers who are picking up that part of the levy and on to the state. And as you can see, it would cost the state between $13 and $14 million. And so with like that, I would like to introduce Mr. Marshall Halleck, who's the finance director from the City of Red Wing.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Halleck.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Marshall Halleck, and I'm the finance director for the City of Red Wing. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. And thanks to Senator Saxhog for bringing this legislation forward. At the Prairie Island Nuclear Plant located in Red Wing, there is a significant amount of equipment that qualifies as pollution control equipment. This includes the primary containment, the reactor vessel isolation system, and the electrical safeguard system, amongst other things. We could all agree that that's the kind of equipment that we'd like to see at a nuclear facility. However, when the state gives a tax preference for a certain type of property, that means that others in the community carry an additional property tax burden. Statewide, there's approximately $800 million of value tied up in pollution control equipment, representing about $14 million in property taxes that are simply shifted onto other local taxpayers. According to a 2010 study by the Department of Revenue, approximately one-third of the value of the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant is included as exempt pollution control equipment. If that value were captured as part of our property tax base, our combined property tax rate would decrease about 7.5%. For us, this is simply a matter of fairness. As the chart we distributed shows, since 1994, city property taxes have increased in the aggregate approximately 68%. With non-utility property taxes increasing over 220%. In the same period, utility property taxes rose only 0.24%, less than 1%, 0.24%, compared to non-utility property taxes increasing 220%. In recent years, legislation has lowered the class rate on utility property, and the Department of Revenue has changed the method for valuing utility property, resulting in lower valuations coupled with faster and fuller depreciation. All of this has resulted in significant volatility in the value of utility property across the state. The utilities may argue that they should not be treated differently than any other business. Naturally, the very nature of their business and their status as a regulated industry suggests that they are different from other industries with their guaranteed rate of return and other powers such as eminent domain. The very size of their operations and the amount of value associated with their property make them different from other industries. All Minnesotans benefit from safe, reliable, affordable electricity and the pollution control measures that are currently exempted from local property taxes. If the state believes this property should receive a tax preference, then the local communities host to public electric utilities should not have to solely bear the burden of the exemptions and tax preferences. As the entire state enjoys the benefits of the pollution control equipment, we support the state contributing to the tax preference for such. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Sachs, I am looking at the testifiers list. I think that the rest of them are going to be opponents. So questions, members of these gentlemen? Senator Saxhog, I know this issue's been around a while. Former Senator Murphy worked on this. I think I probably even carried this legislation. In the time that I was looking at it, my recollection is that in conversations with the department, there were things like parking lots that were receiving this personal property exemption. And the rationale is in the language, because the Pollution Control Agency doesn't care, and the utility just wants to pay less property tax. So I'm contemplating, and I'd like you guys to consider, if we would take on line 1.11, where it says use primarily for, and change that to directly and only related to. I'm not going to offer that today, but I want to have that out for discussion. Senator Saxog, what do you want?
I would, Mr. Chair, members, I think that that would make sense. Consider that up.
You guys think about it. We're going to work on this, but I want to hear the testimony from the other side now, and I wanted to bring that up while you guys are at the table.
So. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else for these two gentlemen? Any questions, members?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's bring up Mr. Johnston, Mr. Jago, Ms. Jago, and Mr. Evans. I think there'll be room for all three of you.
Thanks for working.
So, pull a chair up. Oh, is there another one? Well, two is fine. Welcome to the committee, whoever wishes to start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Larry Johnston with Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. We're a nonprofit wholesale generation and transmission company that serves 18 member cities that we have in our system. I want to take just a brief moment to suggest that these revenues from the exemption are extremely important to our members. It's about a $3 million exchange for us. That would be about a 1.5% rate increase. The only other point that I would make with regard to that at this juncture is that, you know, on the last 18 months, we've seen kind of an unprecedented amount of requirements and requests coming from EPA in terms of modernization of plants. I understand that these are laws that all of us are going to have to comply with, but we're consistently seeing more and more cost and investments in environmental controls. From that standpoint, the discussion actually in the utility industry has shifted a little bit to can you continue to afford to operate these plants, which plants should be shuttered. And so we just need to be careful in this process, and I think the bill intends to try to maintain that relationship. It just shifts it as you've heard here. We do have one potential unintended consequence that we see with the A3 amendment, where we're in a little bit different situation because we're a municipal power agency. We do not pay income tax. And so we're just concerned that somehow there's an opportunity where we might go to work with revenue on this, and the reaction might be, you guys don't pay this. We don't have a mechanism to refund. We've been working with the author. They're happy to work with some very simple language for us to try to resolve that issue as the bill moves forward. I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. And I would encourage everybody to keep working on this. I think I've indicated my support for something moving forward, so let's keep working on it. Thank you, Mr. Johnston.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy, and I do have a handout I'd like to have distributed to the committee.
Page available.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to I appeared in front of the committee a couple of days ago and talking on a similar issue, and I don't want to belabor that point, but let me just make a couple of comments. The charts that we're passing out today are similar to the chart we passed out the other day in the committee. It's a little more granular. It looks at a little shorter timeline, and it looks at specific pieces of property that XL Energy owns that would be subject to this property tax. As the committee knows from the prior testimony, utility companies are the only companies in the state that pay personal property taxes. After this bill passes, if it were to pass, utility companies would pay personal property taxes on their pollution control equipment as well as their other equipment. But other industries that have pollution control equipment would still not pay personal property tax, just as they don't pay personal property tax on any of their equipment. What this chart shows, similar to the chart I passed out the other day, is the green line in this chart represents the real property tax that we pay just as any other property owner in Minnesota would. The blue line on this represents the personal property tax that we pay to our host communities in addition to the real property tax. And as you can see in each of these cases, those lines are diverging. I misspoke. The blue line represents the total property tax that we pay. So the gap between the two lines represents the personal property tax. And as you can see, those lines are diverging. That's because we're making investments in our plants, and those investments are increasing the value of the personal property and thereby increasing the amount that we pay in personal property tax. The red line indicates our projection of where the total property tax would go if we paid personal property tax on the pollution control equipment that is located at these plants. And as you can see, it's quite a bit different, where in Monticello it would make a difference, but not much of a difference. In, for example, Becker, it would make a significant difference. And that just has to do with how much pollution control equipment is located at those various plants. There's more at the coal plants than there is at the nuclear plants, for example. So I guess, you know, that really is the end of my testimony. This is the impact that it would have. I appreciate the amendment that Senator Saxhog put on today, which would attempt to balance this payment for the utility. We have some concerns about how that exactly would work, just sort of the details of it, but we continue to work with the author to try to understand that. I appreciate the effort, though, because I think it does obviously solve at least one of the problems if we can find a way for it to work. But it is, I think, important for the tax committee to understand that what we would then be doing is shifting from the state general fund to a handful of communities who would receive a benefit represented by the divergence of the red and the blue lines on these charts. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And Mr. Evans, I want to make sure that I'm reading your chart right. So let's look at the Sherkel plant. So your real property taxes are 2.4 or 2.3 or something. The personal property tax gets up to 8.4 maybe or 6. So that's about $6 million. And then we go from 9 to 17. So that's $8 million. So are you trying to tell me that the Sherkel plant, that over half of your personal property is related to pollution control?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I haven't dissected that data. I certainly can do that, but there's a couple of things that would be going on there. First of all, the bulk of the personal property that is there has been there for a long time, and so it's been depreciated. And so the blue line does represent a certain amount of depreciation of existing property. On the other hand, the pollution control equipment, particularly as we go off into the future, that we will be installing at that plant is going to be brand new. You know, obviously, you know, in the way the world works today, the Clean Air Act and all the federal regulations, pollution control equipment is a big part of the investments we're making at those plants. So that will come in at full value before it starts depreciating. So I suspect that, and I'll check this out and get more specific information, but I suspect that that thing that you're the fact that you're noting there is due to the fact that the pollution control equipment has not depreciated as much as the rest of the equipment that's located at the plant.
And Mr. Evans, I was around here when that depreciation occurred, and I understand that that was not without controversy also at the speed at which that, in my opinion, accelerated depreciation was allowed. I think if you do the math on this, you're going to see that the Sherkel plant in Becker, the utility is claiming that over half of its personal property is related to pollution control, and I find that almost unbelievable. But having said that, did you hear my discussion about the change in the language that would require this exemption to be directly and only related to pollution control equipment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And what do you think of that?
I heard it for the first time today, so I'll have to go talk to some people, you know, and get back to you on that. I will say this, that within the last couple of years, there was a study done of the pollution control equipment. It's a fairly extensive one that lists the equipment and facilities that are subject to the exemption, and I think that, you know, it certainly would behoove all of us to go back through that and make sure that, you know, our point certainly is to have covered what is legitimately covered as pollution control equipment and not something like a parking lot. So to the extent that there's a concern about that, that certainly should be addressed.
And Mr. Evans, you know that earlier testifiers said that this is mandatory, and I think you indicated that this is mandatory. So why is the state incentivizing what is already being mandated?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd have to say I wasn't around when the pollution control exemption was put on, and I don't know, you know, all of the reasons that that might have been done. You know, as I pointed out before in my testimony, there is personal property in the state associated with other kinds of industrial facilities that are not utilities that is not subject to the pollution or to the personal property tax. I don't know why that is, but, you know, obviously there was a decision made at some point that it would apply to utilities and not to other facilities. There are industrial facilities that are not utility facilities in the state that have their own pollution control equipment, and that's not subject to the tax. So I'm afraid I don't, you know, obviously there's a public policy decision that was made, and I can't really tell you why.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Evans. I appreciate you coming here today. Questions, members? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saxhog, there's an income tax credit that goes along with this, right?
Correct.
So if with that, aren't you really just shifting money from the tax that the utilities would pay? They would get an income tax credit, but the cities would end up being the winners, and the general fund would go down.
Senator Saxon.
Chair, Senator Ortman, what you're talking about here, of course, is the host cities. The host cities are the ones that have been taking the hit in terms of the lower taxes that the utilities have been paying. And as you know, just because they pay lower taxes doesn't mean that that the rest of the commercial industrial taxpayers in the communities, they have to take up the slack. And that's what we're talking about here, is that the state would make its host communities whole.
Well, Mr. Chair, that doesn't really address my question. I'm trying to understand what happens with the money. I'm trying to track the money. So if the utilities are asked to pay a higher property tax, personal property tax, but they get an income tax deduction as a result or credit, that credit, when it gets paid for, will be paid for by all Minnesotans because there will be less money going to the general fund because of the credit, which means that credit, in essence, is going to these host cities. Isn't that how the bill actually works? That's what I'm asking you. And if not, maybe council can answer the question.
Senator Ortman, if you don't mind, maybe I can help a little bit here. I think that the debate is centering around who's going to pay the costs. We all realize that the cost of pollution control occur. And currently, the host city is bearing it all, because it's property tax exempt and shifting out onto whoever is in that jurisdiction. Some of the earlier discussions have been revolved around whether perhaps the ratepayers should pay that cost as opposed to just the host city. Now, this is another mechanism that would bring some state dollars to bear, and you're right, those state dollars would flow to the host community as opposed to the ratepayers in some of the other discussions we've had.
Well, Mr. Chair, then the follow-up question for me is, do these cities get other subsidies from the state? And don't they also have the benefit with these huge employers in their areas with all the employment that they bring into the community?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know who that's directed at.
Well,
Senator Saxon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, let's just take the Clay Boswell plant that's located in Itasca County area and specifically in Cohasset. 60 years ago when that came in, this huge plant was put right in the middle of the city, and it was welcomed because it brought jobs, approximately 200 jobs, and tax base, which was, as you know, in northern Minnesota, where we have all the public land, we don't have a lot of tax base, so it was welcome. 60 years later, we still have those 200 good jobs, But because of accelerated depreciation, because of rate decreases and the like, you know, we're dealing with considerably less tax base from Minnesota Power, and we're just trying to figure out a way where we can kind of make that difference up. And using the pollution control equipment, which is personal property, and we understand the deduction for it, but you know we've got to deal with it, and we're asking the state of Minnesota to help us.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Ortman, we have two more testifiers.
I'll be brief. Okay. I have to disagree with what you're trying to accomplish here, because it seems to me that the utility companies were doing a good thing by installing pollution control equipment. They probably were incentivized to do it, and now they've done it, and now we're going to turn around and tax them for being good in terms of the environment. And I just don't know where we're heading with this. It seems like it's a penalty to these companies for doing well and doing what we've asked them to do instead of it being good tax policy, and the taxpayers across the state are going to be asked to pay for these additional subsidies to the host cities.
And Senator Ortman, I think if you had listened to the earlier testimony, that it was particularly about the new investment that the company is putting on and the projections of the personal property tax increases. They did have some pretty significant acceleration of depreciation allowed on this equipment. So I think the testimony was primarily with the new investments that were coming, but certainly some of the existing ones would have a role in this. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have two short questions, one for each of the testifiers. The first question I have is for Mr. Evans. Chair Skoy, you've often talked about the overburden that's put on communities, and I think this is what I understand this bill is trying to get at, what the utilities, what type of overburden they might cause on the host communities. And so, Mr. Evans, I'm wondering if you can describe for me, I'm looking on the charts here, and I'm looking at the green line, which shows the commercial and industrial property taxes, and then I'm looking at the blue line, which is, I think, our current, what you're currently paying, which is the C&I property taxes plus the personal property taxes, and I would like to know, that difference between those two lines is pretty significant. It looks like it's about $6 million, at least on the Sherco plant, and maybe similar amounts on all the others. My question is that, what is that exactly? Is this the overburden? I mean, what's the, is this money in the overburden payment to these cities already?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess I Senator Nelson, I wouldn't use the term overburden. We're not seeking to reduce the personal property tax. What I would say is that this represents the amount of tax that we pay to these communities that is in addition to what we would pay if we were not a utility company. So, and that was, again, as I mentioned with the chair, I wasn't around when all this policy was passed, so I'm not familiar with all of the debate that went on, but for whatever reason, the policy was determined that that amount of money would be paid to these communities in addition to what we would ordinarily pay if we were not a utility company. So, but I think, you know, your point is correct, that gap there represents the difference between what we would pay if we manufactured, you know, shoes as opposed to manufacturing electricity.
Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair. So actually that was what I was trying to get at, which looks like, so this is a particular increase in your property taxes because you are a utility that no one else would pay. And we assume there was good rationale for that back when that happened. I just wasn't here yet either. Now, and then my second question is for Mr. Evans, and it has to do with the numbers. I believe that the one of Senator Saxhog's testifiers in favor of the bill, one of the mayors, said that passing this particular piece of legislation would decrease the city property tax by 7.5%. And I thought I heard, and I don't know how many people that is, and I'm sure the mayor can give me that info. But Mr. Johnson, I thought I heard you say that this legislation would increase for Southeast Minnesota for SEMPA ratepayers, it would increase rates by 1.5% for all ratepayers. And I'm wondering how many ratepayers is that?
Mr. Johnston.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, when you look across the entire SEMPA rate base, both residential, our members' residential and CNI customers, it's probably in the realm of $110,000, $115,000, something like that.
Okay. And, oh, Mr. Chair, could you indulge one more
Senator
question?
Nelson.
The same question for Mr. Evans.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, we serve approximately half the residents of the state, so I haven't calculated what the rate impact would be on our customers the way Mr. Johnston did, so I can't tell you what that might be. But we serve approximately half of the residents of Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Saxog had mentioned earlier about the city's taking a hit. That's trying to understand that. You look at taxation and principles of taxation, there's various parts of it, fair and transparent and it's adequate. And I guess I'm kind of looking at adequacy here. When you say taking a hit, do we know how much these cities are spending? We're always talking about the revenue side. We're coming up here, we're looking for more revenue for something. Do we have some information on how much these cities are spending, say, operationally or on operations or capital per capita, and how those 8 or 9 cities compare to the rest of the state? In other words, I'm looking at need here. Is there truly a need for these areas to go out and get extra money? Somebody, Senator Ortman, alluded to the fact that do some of these cities already have their own sales tax? Do they have a liquor tax? Do they have a lodging tax? Do they get LGA? They get PILT or something else. So is it in addition to that? And what are we talking about spending? Do we know how much they're spending per capita comparing to anybody else to get to the adequacy? Are their needs being adequately met? And if they are, why do we have to keep singling out, again, violating another principle, singling out one industry that provides a vital, vital service to the community and to the state? And raising the rates on others. And in this case, the third point is shifting it to the general fund for eight or nine areas. So do we know how much they spend on the other side of the equation, not just the revenue, but what are we spending in these cities compared to the rest of the state?
Senator Chamberlain, I think that would be more appropriately directed to Mr. Hallock, and when we're done with the other testifiers, we'll bring him back up. So, gentlemen, thank you very much, Mr. Pagel and Ms. Jagel. With regard to the hit to these communities, let me just clarify. These communities had a significantly higher contribution from the utilities a dozen years ago in their property tax and their personal property tax. As Mr. Evans testified, there's been significant depreciation, some of it due to Department of Revenue decisions, I think some of it due to court cases. And then there's also been rate changes. Their rate was reduced. Well, so those property taxes shifted on to the other residents of the area, the community, the jurisdiction, the school district, the county, and the city. That's part of what this discussion is revolving around. And, some people think, let the locals pay. They get the jobs. Some people think that this is a larger issue than just the city of Becker or Redwood. But for the question of what they're spending, we'll bring Mr. Hallock back up after these testimonies. Senator Saxon.
And I just wanted to make one comment, Mr. Chair. Senator Chamberlain, the last thing you said was that they're vital to the state, so that speaks for itself. But I think if you look at these communities, and you could put these were the ones you have here, of course, are just with XL, but if you took Minnesota Powers and took Cohasset, you would find that these cities and these communities and these counties, their levies have remained stable. They haven't been raising their taxes. They've been doing a good job at taking care of things, but the tax pie doesn't grow. And if If a power producer reduces their share of that pie, the CIs, the rest of the CI and the residential customers in that area have a property tax increase, which nobody else would feel. And I don't think we can see that the commercial industrial taxpayers of Minnesota have been getting the rate changes and accelerated depreciation that the power companies have. So I think we have a different situation here.
Ms. Yeagle, am I mispronouncing your name?
No, it's correct.
State your name for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Jagel, and I'm the tax manager of Minnesota Power. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak, and I am here to speak in opposition to this Senate File 1026, which repeals the property tax exemption for pollution control and adds the corporate income tax credit equal to the property tax exemption and additional property taxes that will be paid. Minnesota Power is opposed to this property tax proposal for several reasons. First, as we've already discussed, it does single out utilities, and specifically electric utilities, for increasing revenues for the benefit of the host communities. And this proposal does intend to funnel more local property tax funds to the local communities and to be paid for by the utilities, which will then be reimbursed by all state taxpayers to reimburse the cost, the additional revenues that are going to the local communities. This proposal is another instance where the utilities are taxed differently than all other taxpayers in the state. Imposing this tax on the electric utilities is unfair. If the local communities need these additional revenues, we feel that they should look to other local aid programs instead of creating this additional tax to increase their revenues. Second, we believe that this appears to be an unprecedented taxing solution, combining a property tax and an income tax proposal, which we believe is fraught with risk and uncertainty. While the proposal ties the two different taxes together upon enactment, there's no guarantee that these two separate tax sections will remain intertwined. The state could decide in the future not to fund this property tax increase by ending or limiting this refundable income tax credit, which is paid for by the general fund, which would then leave the electric utilities with a permanent property tax increase. The uncertainty and potential risk of this permanent property tax increase is of great concern to our large power customers in the mining industry, as they would bear the risk of the burden of the permanent tax increase. Third, as I mentioned last week, this utility property tax increase is not in line with the governor's budget proposal to balance the sources of revenue within the state and further increases the disparity between the property tax revenues and the income tax revenues. Lastly, this property tax increase does not follow the recommendations of the Property Tax Working Group, which issued their report in November of 2012. The goal of the Property Tax Working Group was to make recommendations to make the Minnesota property tax system more simple, understandable, transparent, accountable, and efficient. One of the guiding principles of the recommendations was to defend broad-based property tax goals for narrow interests and avoid creating new benefits for narrow subgroups of property. This proposal, we believe, is in direct contrast to this guiding principle. So in summary, we believe this tax unfairly targets the utilities and is not in the best interest of the tax goals of the state, and therefore it should be opposed. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And so, Ms. Jagel, when you boil this down, you're saying that you would prefer to have the property taxpayers in the community that host your electrical generation facilities pay this as opposed to the state general fund?
I believe that there could be other mechanisms to look at, such as local community aid or other funding sources, rather than additional property taxes, specifically pass through the electric utility as a funnel.
Thank you. Mr. Pagel.
Chair, my name is Craig Pagel. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the customers that do pay the increases. We do appreciate the amendment that places the income tax provision that there would be a credit. However, as Ms. Jago spoke about, there is a concern that that will stay in this bill. If it doesn't, or if it's taken out at other times, this would be a $2 to $3 million annual increase to the mining industry. Basically, a nickel a ton is about what we'd figured it as. I think it's important as we're looking at different bills that are going around that, again, everyone's looking for general fund money and have a concern that that might not stay in this part of the bill. What I'd like to also kind of remind, and it was touched by Ms. Jago, Minnesota Power built their Unit 4 about 1980 for about $1 billion. Within the last couple of years and what they're going to be putting in Unit 4 for just environmental controls, mostly for mercury, Boswell 3 was $300 million. Boswell 4 that's going to be done is estimated to be $400 million. Of that, $300 million will be just for environmental controls. So we've basically, the cost of that plant, those expenditures are going to be right back up to where it was originally built. That's why we're seeing that most of these costs would probably come back to the industry itself, and that's why we'd oppose it. We understand it's a difficult situation for the host communities, but it does put the burden back on the ratepayers in one way or another, whether it's tax directly or if it's going to be in our rates.
Thank you, Mr. Pagan.
Thank you.
Questions, members? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I do wonder if the alternative approach were applied here, Senator Saxhog, do you know what the impact would be to the ratepayers? If you just said, okay, well, we think that the host community should be provided more benefit, and we're just going to impose those costs directly on the ratepayers, do you know what it would cost?
Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Ortman. I think we could get Mr. Halleck, the financial director of the city of Red Wing, up here.
That'd be great.
Might have an idea.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Diego. Thank you, Mr. Pagel. Mr. Halleck, got any information to help us understand the city of Red Wing's? Senator Chamberlain had a question about the city of Red Wing. How's your levy increases doing? How are your finances and compared to the others? Do you receive other state aids and credits?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Chamberlain. I'll try to address a couple of the questions, the different questions separately. Insofar as Red Wing is concerned, we take pride that our financial health is solid. We're proud of that. What have we done over the since 1994, for example, through today? On an annual basis, and as members of this committee and the chair are aware, that with all the idiosyncrasies in tax law, property taxes, LGA, market value homestead credits, there's been a tremendous amount of change. So between 1994 and 2013, we had a lot of different issues arise. But on average, the city of Red Wing's property tax, we've seen an annualized increase of 2.75%, well below the rate of inflation over that same period. As I stated previously, during that same period of time, the property taxes in aggregate have increased about 68%, 67.59% to be exact. And because of shifts in property tax burdens, changes in administrative rules regarding valuation of utilities, property tax exemptions, tax court challenges, a host of different things, what we've seen over that same time from 1994 to 2013, when Red Wing's aggregate property taxes increased 67.5%, we've seen non-utility property taxes increase 220%, a little over 220%. At the same time, the property taxes contributed by utilities have increased less than 1%. As a matter of fact, less than 1/4 of 1%, at 0.24%. What does Red Wing receive as far as state aids? We're fortunate that we receive some state aids. We appreciate that. For example, under current proposals, next year we'll receive approximately, if the new LGA formula goes through, $469,000 in local government aid. This year we'll receive $619,000 in local government aid. Outside of that, of course, we receive what a lot of communities do, police aids, fire aids, things of that nature, too, and we appreciate that support because we believe they go for important services that we provide the community. I heard a lot of questions, or I heard insinuation that the community, for example, Red Wing, is looking for new revenues. The fact here is that we are not looking for new revenues. We're not looking to expand programs or somehow receive a windfall. As I stated in my testimony, this is, for us, an issue of fairness. We've got a pollution control exemption bill which serves the interests of the entire state. We all want clean water, clean air, and things of that nature. But because of the tax preference provided by the state, the other property taxpayers in Red Wing, Red Wing Shoe being one of our famous ones, has a higher tax burden because of that preference provided to the utility. That to us is an issue of fairness. If the entire state benefits by the pollution control exemptions, then we would appreciate the discussion about the entire state contributing towards that exemption. Mr. Chair, I may have missed one or two of the other questions, but I'll try to answer them if I can.
You did well. Thank you. Members, we've spent better part of an hour on this. Senator Ortman.
Well, it was my question that was missed, and I appreciate the testimony of the Red Wing administrator. What I'm getting at is that the general fund, you're saying that the general fund should be reduced to provide this benefit to the city. And I'm wondering, isn't the most direct route to just say the ratepayers should pay if they're getting this benefit? And I'm trying to figure out how much would the impact be to the ratepayers if we just went directly to the ratepayers? Because I think most people would oppose that, but I'm wondering what would be the impact?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I'm not privy to the utilities data on their rates or customer base or anything of that nature. I will give it a good attempt to try to figure out a response to your question that meets the need that you have. And hopefully in the next couple of days I can send a letter to the committee or the committee chair.
Senator Ehrman, perhaps if I was to get a hold of Mr. Glautag, I see he's sitting there, Mr. Evans, he's been here, Ms. Jagel, and we'll request some information from them and distribute it to the entire committee. Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mayor. And I think we have to start managing expectations here. In the world, there's a lot of things that aren't predictable and are predictable. Another one of these tax ideas is predictability. And some community or somebody in the state suffers a downturn or something changes in the market, and we're running up here and we want to change something to adjust some tax law for a small number of people, whether it's border cities or cities that have utility electric generation plants in them. So we lack predictability. There's a lot of simplicity's gone out the window a long time ago. But, you know, one thing that happens in the private sector, I'm sure you do it at the city level to an extent, is that you have to manage your cash, your revenues, and your expenses. And you have to make plans for this. And it seems to me that sometimes there's a lot of work that goes into finding new revenue sources instead of planning. I know plenty of cities that plan, plan for these expenses and these eventualities. And we all know that equipment depreciates. We all know these things. Businesses deal with it all the time. And by the way, the utility plants are not the only companies that have depreciation issues. I mean, every business in the community deals with depreciation to some extent. So whether it's in changes in their property values, whatever the case might be, but some things we can't predict, some things we don't know, but it seems to me that instead of doing a better job at planning for these ups and downs, we're just, we're spending money out there, and we're not looking at the other side of the equation. What is the other side of the equation? The other side of the equation is spending. spending. And I don't know, I would still like to see a comparison of the capital outlays in per capita with the rest of the state. I've seen some data that suggests that some of these cities have a higher than average capital and operating outlays than the rest of the cities in the state. That is, these cities in these that have the utility plants in them are spending more per capita, both on operations and capital, than they are on than other cities are on average. Now, there's variability in there, but that seems to be the case. Now, we had a bill here a couple weeks ago where I forget what town it was, Brainerd, Bemidji.
Senator Chamberlain, could you focus in at the issue?
I will focus in on that, but the point is, they go out, they say, yeah, we can afford to do this, and then a couple of years later, they can't afford to do it, they're not capturing the revenue, then they come back and expect the state to say, pay for our civic center, which the citizens didn't want in the first place. Or now,
Senator Chamberlain,
we got predictable.
That is not an accurate statement. That community was asking for a local option sales tax, not state dollars.
Well, they're coming back because they didn't plan for that eventuality. And now we failed to plan for eventualities and depreciation in equipment. And I got data that suggests that you're collecting more in property taxes from these facilities because they put in new equipment, not necessarily pollution control equipment, but they invest in their plant. So that raises the value of the property, and you collect more on that. So I think it's, again, inherently unfair to single out these industries that provide this service and then transfer that in the way that Senator Ortman said, in not so transparent manner, to the citizens of the state through the general fund. So I would really like people to focus on spending side, and I'd like to see some of those other numbers. I'm sorry I was long-winded. Thank you.
And Senator Chamberlain, I think the testimony was pretty clear that this is not an increase in revenue to the city of Red Wing or any other host community. The question is simply whether the host community pays through their property tax or some other mechanism, whether previous bills, which have been ratepayers, this bill happens to be state general fund. Thank you, Senator Saxog. I would encourage you to keep working on this. I don't think we're quite got it figured out yet. I did mention some language earlier that I think you guys ought to contemplate. Anything else, members? Anybody else in the audience wish to testify on Senate File 1026? Seeing no one, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 1026 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Champion.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you so much for hearing Senate File 1194. Would you like for me to proceed,
Welcome
Mr. Chair?
Welcome to the committee. Proceed, Senator.
Thank you so much. This bill would provide, Senate File 1194, this bill would provide a statutory tax exemption for the Target Center, which is located in Minneapolis. The Target Center's major tenants are the Timberwolves and the Lynx, as well as there's a health club and a restaurant as well. The Target Center, unlike the Excel Center, TCF Bank Stadium, Target Field, the Metrodome, and the new Viking Stadium, does not have specific language granting a property tax exemption, as do the other facilities. Senate File 1194 would provide for such an exemption and would level the playing field with the other facilities and hopefully lead to discussions that could result in a much-needed coordination among the numerous publicly owned facilities. Target Center was originally built and owned by private partnership who also owned the Timberwolves. The city also participated in the project by issuing $22 million in TIF bonds in 1988 to prepare the site. In 1994, the team and the facilities were sold. Glenn Taylor led a group that purchased the team, and the city of Minneapolis was authorized by legislation to purchase the facilities, and the city paid approximately $54.6 million for the building and issued general operating bonds to finance the purchase. The team and the health club have continued to pay property taxes or personal property taxes. They are considered personal property taxes because they are lien on the business and not the property. The taxes are primarily used to service the TIF district debt The district this district will terminate in 2013. The timing of the legislation will permit the tax exemption to occur as the TIF district expires. And so the bill permits property taxes, and especially if you look at lines 1.21 to 1.24, to continue to be collected for the restaurant and the health club. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to present a testifier, a City Council member, Elizabeth Glinton.
Welcome, Council member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Elizabeth Glidden here on behalf of the city. And just to be brief, we wanted to make sure you knew that we were in support of this. We think this is an opportune time as responsible stewards of the Target Center, which we own, to be asking for parity with other large facilities who also have property tax exemption. And again, just to emphasize, the personal property taxes will remain being collected on other uses within the facility, which are the restaurant and the health club. And I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions, members? Mm-hmm. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Champion. So the TIF district that the Target Center is in is expiring. And so and the Target Center is, or the city or the Economic Development Authority is currently collecting property taxes on that property to pay off the bonds or whatever. So how is this any different than just asking for an extension of the TIF district so that the Target Center is not paying any property taxes to the to support the general fund budget of the city of Minneapolis?
Councilmember Glidden.
Well, in some ways it wouldn't be different because, as example, the state is now, because it is a TIF district, not collecting property taxes on this facility. What this would allow, though, is for us, again, to have sort of a similar arrangement as exists with other large facilities. Again, we own this facility, so one way or another, we are responsible for how we're able to continue the management of this property, and we would be negotiating, as we are right now, with the Timberwolves on how we're able to renovate the facility, and this is part of that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
So the way in which the TIF district is structured, what is the relationship of the Target Center in paying the statewide business property tax?
Ms. Glidden.
Does it? Does it contribute in that at all, or is that not the way the TIF district is structured?
I am looking for Mr. Ranieri or someone
right
else.
There.
There he is. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Director of Intergovernmental Relations for the City of Minneapolis. Senator Rest, the statewide property tax is paid by the Target Center and the district.
And so, Mr. Chairman, so Mr. Ranieri, if we granted a property tax exemption, is it only for the local property tax, or would the state general fund also take a hit?
Mr. Ranieri.
Senator Scott, Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, it's my understanding that the property tax, the statewide property tax, would still be paid by the facilities that are there, the restaurant and the health facility.
But not the Target Center itself.
Mr. Ranieri.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, that's my understanding, yes.
And
Senator Rest.
Is there, Mr. Chairman, is there a fiscal note here that shows how much loss there would be to the state?
Senator Rest, I think it's $120,000 in 2015, $130,000 in 2016, and
Mr.
quite
Chair.
A bit more, $260,000 in 2017. I don't exactly know why that is.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, on that fiscal note, isn't that for property tax refunds to other people?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing that the statewide property tax there wouldn't be one, because isn't that the fixed amount? And if this comes out of it, others would be
paying it.
Be a shift instead of a loss to the fund?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Ranieri.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I think you are correct, because mm-hmm. the statewide property tax is a set levy. I think it's around $800 million this year. And I think the amount paid by the Target Center is about $357,000.
So,
Senator Rest.
So, City of Minneapolis is asking my CI property taxpayers to pick up the slack for the Target Center. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman.
Voted question, I understand.
Senator Rest, that not only would be also in the residents of the city of Minneapolis, too, would be picking it up.
Senator Champion, I think you have an amendment, and this is your first stop, so we're going to author's amendment. Apologize for not getting it on earlier. Senator Dietzick.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair, we do have an amendment.
I have an amendment, but I also have a follow-up question, I believe.
Senator Dietzick, let's put the amendment on first. Senator Dietzick moves the A1 amendment. That's been passed out.
Thank you.
We'll consider this an author's amendment. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe there were other entities up here earlier this year also asking to be put in as proper, as tax exempt in the city of St. Paul, and I don't want to get into a food fight in the with the city of St. Paul and with the burbs. But it is you have other entities out there and other facilities out there that are not paying property taxes, and so it is just a level playing field issue in my mind.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope I didn't miss this. Usually when they bring these things, type of things forward, like TIFs, et cetera, we ask, do we know what the school districts think about this? Have they weighed in, and are they happy with this?
I believe our mayor has had
Ms.
some.
Glidden.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go through the chair. Ms. Glidden.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. Because this has been part of a TIF district, the school district has not been getting direct property taxes for some time from this facility, and I believe that our mayor has reached out to the superintendent about the fact that we were bringing this request to the state legislature.
Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we don't know that the school districts have officially spoke to this, and we haven't heard them, or the mayor apparently has talked to them. They said that's fine. I don't know that. Just in the previous bill, we were talking about should the local people pay for the utility company, and if we don't do that, take care of that property tax exemption for the pollution control stuff, that burden of taxation shifts to local businesses and local residents. Well, that was for utility plants. They provide an important service. Now, I like the Timberwolves. I like to go to Target Center. But here we have a game, a sporting event, and we're saying the utility companies, they should keep paying and pay more. But when it comes to, and we don't, because we don't want to shift it to the residents or the other businesses, when it comes to the basketball arena, it's okay to exempt them and shift those tax burdens to other businesses and other residents. So there may not be an answer to this, but I want to make that clear what we're doing here again. It's okay sometimes, and this violates probably another half dozen principles of taxation. We want to know why we keep coming back up here for this stuff, because we keep making it more complicated. We talk simplicity, but we don't do that. We talk fairness, and it's fair to tax them for not do it for utility company, but it's okay to play basketball. So there may not be an answer. You may comment on that, but I think we're not doing ourselves any favors here.
Thank you, Senator Chamberlain. Anything else, members?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Did we discuss the significance of the A1 amendment? I'm reading this.
Maybe we should go through that a little bit.
Yes, I have some
Nelson,
questions
very
on
good
that.
Question. It was an author's amendment, but can you tell us what the changes are from the bill as introduced, Senator Chamberlain?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have Ms. Glidden talk about the significance of the amendment.
Councilmember Glidden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'll be brief, but the significance of this is with the construction manager at risk is doing something that is similar to what happened with the Viking Stadium, which is a design, bid, build type of process. It's similar to that. Both the Timberwolves and the City of Minneapolis support this as important to be able to get the project done on a certain timeline. We have also been in direct conversation with folks like our Civil Rights Department about how this helps us to achieve goals with the project, and they feel this is beneficial to that as well.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Just a follow-up question then. So in section 2, paragraph B, where it talks about somehow selecting a short list of responsible offerers. Is that common practice, and is public bidding still a part of the process?
Councilwoman Glidden.
We may want to have a letter submitted that kind of goes to this. I believe that your comment is correct, that public bidding is still part of the I know that public bidding is still part of the process. I am not sure how it works kind of through what the construction manager once chosen does. So that may be something that needs to be explained in a letter. I just don't want to misspeak and make sure our experts can explain it the best way.
Could we get more information on that, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely. Yes. If you would get that to Senator Nelson and the committee, we'd appreciate it. Senator Dietzick?
Mr. Chair, thank you. My understanding is this is a design bid project, which I believe they did on the convention center. I know Hennepin County has the authority to do some design bid projects. I think this MnDOT maybe has done some or has looked at doing some design bid project, and so it still goes out for bid. It just you know, that it may give the local government or who's ever doing it a little more authority, because currently you design the project and then you bid it out and then you build it. And so this just so you kind of do the design build. You still have you might still have community discussions on what you want to see, what you want to see the final outcome to be, but you have a little more flexibility in doing the project when you're building it. I know at least that's what Hennepin County has done. So.
And Mr. Chair, in the section that the senators or committee members are speaking to, section 2B, it really speaks to a bifurcation around how do you get requests for proposals out and solicit individuals to submit proposals. So one section of it is to make sure that it's being published in a newspaper. The other aspect of it is so that there's a short list of sometimes individuals you work with all the time, and you want to make sure that you also send that information out to them as well, so that you are capturing it as wide of a pool as possible for individuals to respond to your proposal.
Thank you. Senator
Sanjan. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Chamberlain, or either of your witnesses.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, my last name is Champion. Mr. Senator Chamberlain is over there.
I withdraw the bill.
I know that we look alike, but I know it happens.
I keep looking at Senator Chamberlain. Senator Champion.
I really started something.
I've started something. Does this... And I've just been looking through this and thinking through last year. And just help me confirm this. Does this tinker at all with the ratios or the amounts that were prescribed as part of the Viking Stadium deal, if you will? State Vikings in Minneapolis?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sinjum, no, it doesn't tinker with that at all.
Thanks.
Well, to that point, but aren't you trying to make this consistent with some of the provisions that was afforded the stadium last year? So while it's not directly tied, you're trying to be consistent?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you, Senator. Can I clear it up, Senator?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Anything else, members? Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 1194? Seeing none, we'll lay Senate File 1194 over. If we could get that information that was requested, we'd appreciate it. Thank you, Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Senate File 1194 is laid over as amended. And we let Senator Champion go first. He had other committee provisions. Senator Peterson. Welcome, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before you this morning, we have Senate File 1407, which is a bill that seeks to correct, I believe, an unintended consequence and related to some of the legislation that was passed last session, specifically related to the taxes charged to the e-gambling issue in general. I'm here before you today with two women that run what I would call bingo halls. That's the term that they prefer. It's a paper bingo hall. There's just eight of those left in our state. This is an industry that's been devastated in recent years because of some of the things that have been happening here in the legislature, and that continued a little bit last year, and I hope to be able to show you this morning that that's something that I hope this committee is willing to try and correct. I have the A1 amendment to offer.
We're passing the A1 amendment out, Senator. The first committee stop for you.
Yes.
Senator Senjum moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion, members? And you will describe it as you describe the bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, what this...
We need to vote on this. Sure. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair and members, if you had a chance to review the initial bill, you'll see very clearly stated in there in an indented paragraph the current tax rates that are asked from... the e-poll tab situation. You can see that once the gross receipts climb over $87,500, it climbs to 18%, and then to 27%, and then finally 36% when the combined net receipts go over $157,500. What this amendment does is ask you just to take this tax rate just for the paper bingo halls where bingo is their primary business back down to the initial tax rate of 9. You'll see in the original bill we had considered asking for an exemption, and then the bingo halls and the constituents I serve that are dealing with this situation basically said, look, that's not fair, and we believe there should be some taxes. We just want to stay where we're at to put us in a situation. I've been shown that these industries, as I said, there's just eight of them left. The one in my district employs about 40 people. And many of you on this committee have these paper bingo halls in your districts as well, and I think of similar size. And so if we let this continue, I think you'll see these bingo halls eventually go out of business. And so, as I said, I think this is an unintended consequence that I hope you're willing to fix this session. I've been shown the severe impact that this is having on their business. It's a completely different business model that these women will describe for you. I have two guests, Ms. Bonnie Merkling and Ms. Katie McKinney, both who run organizations that do this, and they're here to try and save their businesses, save this service and this entertainment for their customers, and save the jobs and save the employees that work for them. In these, they're going to share actual numbers, tax receipts, just from the last month or two that will show you how this is having a very detrimental impact on their businesses. And quite frankly, we're working to save these institutions in these communities as we move forward. So, Mr. Chair, they're here to testify in favor of
this bill. Senator Peterson, I don't know if I didn't hear it or not, but this is a tax increase that occurred as a part of the effort to pay for the stadium.
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. Yep.
And hopefully these testifiers are able to convince us that this really isn't tied to a Vikings football game. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Merkling. Where would you like to go first? Ms. Merkling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I have been employed by the four organizations at the Bingo Emporium for 25 years. Our organizations are a battered women's shelter.
Could you restate your name for the record?
Bonnie Merkling.
Thank you very much.
Our organizations are the battered women's shelter, which is Anna Marie's, New Beginnings, which is a home for unwed mothers and United Arts, and Cathedral High School. And the four have been together for the 25 years that I've been there. We, as Mr. Peterson, our Senator Peterson, indicated, we suffered a real setback with the smoking ban, took our numbers down considerably. We're starting to kind of see recovery, we thought. And now with the new tax, combined receipts tax, we're actually getting hit pretty hard this year. March was the first month for us to go from a 9% tax to an 18% tax. And I did share the numbers with Senator Peterson. And I can tell you that in March of 2012 versus March of 2013, there's a $500 difference in our deposits for poll tabs. March of 2012 was $500 more. The taxes, though, for our poll tabs, because of going to that 18%, in March of 2012, our taxes for poll tabs were $3,685. And in March of 2013, our taxes were $8,692.83, so roughly a $5,000 increase without any additional revenue. That hits the bottom line really hard. And April, May, and June, we will see another, I'm sure, $5,000 in April for additional taxes above and beyond what we would have paid. By the end of May, I suspect we'll hit the 27%, which means it'll go up in the month of June by at least $10,000. So we're looking at about $28,000 in increased taxes in the month. We will operate more than likely in June at a negative number, which is just really hard for small organizations. I mean, the previous numbers were in the millions, and I'm talking thousands. And the Vikings stadium thing, no, it's not an issue with me, although I'm not necessarily a fan, but... Thank Not you. A football fan. So.
Thank you very much.
All right.
And Ms. McGinnity?
Yes. Thank you, Chairman, committee members. My name is Katie McGinnity. I'm the gambling manager at Little Canada Bingo Hall. I work for the Little Canada Recreation Association, which is a nonprofit in our community that helps promote youth activities in Little Canada. 100% of our profits from the Bingo Hall support youth programs in our city. I'm here today to let you know that the combined receipts tax is having a negative effect on bingo halls. In the first 3 months of 2012, our organization paid $824 in combined receipts tax plus a $4,000 in ideal tax. In 2013, those same months, we have already paid $11,787 in combined receipts tax, and we no longer pay the ideal tax. It's about a $7,000 increase in taxes in just the 3 months, the first 3 months of the year. So I'd like to let you know to keep the bingo halls exempt from tax because this would keep our business. We wouldn't be in business much longer. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And Senator Peterson, I think it would be helpful for the committee as we move forward with this, if I could get a list of the organizations that these contributions are contributing to, the youth sports and those four organizations that you listed, and then any other ones that the other six are contributing to. I think it'll be helpful. Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to speak to just one of those if I could, please. You know, I want to thank Senator Peterson for bringing this bill forward. I was thinking of the Flamingo Bingo Parlor in Rochester, and I want to tell you about that. When my 82-year-old mother-in-law comes here, that is where she wants to go. And she brings all her bingo paraphernalia with her. And it is a fun thing for her to do. It's something she looks forward to. And I've been there with her. And what I've noticed is there are a lot of senior citizens there. And I know how important it is that there be an active, fun, social place like that. And so I thank you for what you provide and for the Flamingo Bingo in Rochester. And what I found out when I was looking today even is that the Flamingo Bingo Parlor is actually run by the Rochester Senior Center, and it's operated under the DBA of the Flamingo Bingo Parlor. So let me just tell you about some of the things that the profits from that do. At the Rochester Senior Center, they provide the ability for computer classes of all types, web writing classes, Facebooking classes, square dancing. That Rochester Senior Center is a beehive of activity of seniors in the all of Southeast Minnesota. And we know that that keeps people active and it keeps their brains active. And my dad has Alzheimer's, and I've been really focused on that issue. And we know one of the most important things we can do is keep our seniors active and keep their brains working. And I'm glad that places like the Flamingo Bingo Parlor not only provide the actual activity, but then the profits actually go to places like the Rochester Senior Center, which provide those further type of mental activities and social opportunities. So thank you, Senator Peterson, and I'm hoping this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Anything else, members? We are have a revenue estimate coming, Senator Peterson, and I am very sympathetic to this. I have an issue, and Senator Nelson and Senator Peterson, my problem is this might become germane to stadium issues on the floor. So we're going to have a discussion.
Mr. Chair, on that. I mean, I saw the bill from yesterday. I don't know how far it's going to go, the memorabilia tax. I know we're going to hear that later. I'd hate to see this issue get mixed up in the Viking Stadium funding. I think it's an entirely different issue, and I hope that we as tax committee members can separate this for our colleagues.
That would be very good, Senator Ortman. So we're going to work on this. We'll get the revenue estimate. If we could get that list of organizations, including the one that Senator Nelson so eloquently talked about, we'll appreciate it. Anything else, members? Anybody else in the audience want to testify on Senate File 1407? Anything else, Senator Peterson?
Mr. Chair, I should just thank Senator Rest as a co-author on the bill, as well as Senator Scalzi and Senator Nelson as well. So I think you've gotten a clear picture. This is a different market. They're not interested in playing electronic games at all, whether that's e-pull tabs. They're looking for a night of entertainment, not just a few minutes and a potential to win a pot. So,
we'll see if we can
thank
get
you.
This done. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sanger.
I don't think it goes by the question. These are. I had a bill a couple of years ago for the specifically for the bingo hall in Rochester. It was frankly just to keep it open. They're very tax sensitive, and in many cases, at least in that situation, a lot of overhead expenses, big parking lots, big roofs, a lot of building repair and things like that that has to be kept up, and yet that profit margin was very, very low. We're able to adjust that through a little tax change, but they're very sensitive, so I hope we can help them.
Okay. Thank you. Chair will lay over Senate File 1407 as amended. Thank you. Thank you, testifiers. Senator Thompson, I see Senator Limmer's here, and you're stuck here anyway. Should we hear his bill first?
Oh, sure.
Senator Limmer.
You're stuck here anyway.
Welcome to Tax Committee, Senator Limmer. We miss you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to be back to the illustrious Tax Committee. I just wanted to introduce and talk a little bit about Senate File 1486 that's before you. This bill regards a fiscal disparity modification upon the request of the City of Rogers. The city has brought to my attention a unique problem that they're suffering under due to the current policies of fiscal disparities. One thing to know before we begin is that the city receives no benefit from the regional wastewater infrastructure system, which was originally a cornerstone argument that justified fiscal disparities in the first place. This bill attempts to lessen the impact due to that unique circumstance on the burden on the City of Rogers. I don't want to steal any thunder from the people from Rogers, especially the mayor. And so at this point, I wish to introduce Mayor Jay Bunting, as well as City Administrator Steve Stommer.
Senator Limmer, I think you have an author's amendment, the A1.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a copy of that right now.
I can we get a copy out to the Senator? Did you get a copy, Senator Limmer?
Oh, I do remember seeing this yesterday.
Senator Ortman moves the A1 amendment.
I'm not. Nope. No, I'm just kidding.
Senator Senya moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oh, same sign. Motion to fail. Amendments adopted.
I'll try it
again later on. Okay.
Mr. Chair, hopefully Senator Libra will duly remember this moment.
I know that he will.
I shall, Mr. Chair, but I just want to know I do appreciate and remember
Senator Limmer.
Tax committee humor. Kind of an inside line.
Senator Ortman, welcome, Mayor Bunting.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to discuss this important topic. My name is Jay Bunting, and I am the Mayor of Rogers. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Metropolitan Fiscal Disparities Program and the impacts it has had in Rogers under current legislation. First off, let me say that the City of Rogers, our City Council, recognizes the basic goals of the Fiscal Disparities Program in maintaining a strong and vibrant region. Our concerns are not with these core goals, but with the practical application and the unintended consequences of the program in some extreme situations. As a clear statistical outlier, the City of Rogers represents one such situation. To illustrate this, let me note the following. The 2012 Tischler-Bice study of the Metropolitan Fiscal Disparities Program found that Rogers contributed by far the largest percentage of tax base to the pool as compared with all other jurisdictions in 2011. In that year, Rogers lost 19.5% of its tax capacity on a net basis to the program. That was 25% greater than the number two city on that list. The net loss of tax base meant that the city tax bill for Rogers homeowners was 34.4% higher because of the fiscal disparities program. Annually, from 2008 through 2013, Rogers contributed an average of 22.2% of our tax capacity to the program on a gross basis. A key justification, as Senator Limmer pointed out, for the fiscal disparities program is that new growth is made possible due to shared regional infrastructure, primarily wastewater treatment, and therefore the benefits of commercial industrial growth should be shared. However, Rogers is not served by a regional wastewater treatment infrastructure and is required to own and operate our own system at significant expense and investment of our local taxpayers. In fact, Rogers is the only significant contributor to the fiscal disparities program that is not served by the regional system. Yet in 2012, the city contributed nearly 24% of its tax capacity to the program on a gross basis. While we believe that more studies should be undertaken with regard to the future of the fiscal disparities program, we also firmly believe that this type of excessive impact needs to be addressed from a fairness perspective, regardless of other changes that may or may not be necessary in the future. To that end, we support Senator Limmer's bill to cap the contribution for municipalities which own and operate their own wastewater treatment facilities, thereby not benefiting from a regional system. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for your time and consideration. I'd now like to have our city administrator share some additional details with you, if that's all right.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Bunting. Mr. Stamer?
Stamer, thank
Stamer.
You. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Steve Stamer. I'm the city administrator for the City of Rogers. Thank you for having us here today. As the mayor mentioned, Rogers is really a concrete example of the excessive impacts that can occur under the current fiscal disparities legislation. And Rogers truly is a statistical outlier with regard to nearly every comparison of impacts within the metropolitan fiscal disparities pool. As the mayor mentioned, Rogers has lost up to 20% of its total tax base in recent years, and that is a net loss of tax base for the city after the contribution and distribution are taken into account. I would refer you to, I believe you have an Exhibit A in your packet that is a list of those cities within the fiscal disparities pool that own and operate their own wastewater treatment facility. And again, that was our Exhibit A, hopefully in your handout. That list shows approximately, I believe, 17 cities, of which five cities on this list would actually be impacted by the proposed legislation under the cap. You'll note that of all the cities in the fiscal disparities pool, of the metropolitan fiscal disparities pool, that do not that are not benefited by the regional wastewater system, that own and operate their own wastewater treatment plant, only Rogers is a significant contributor on a net basis to the program. All others are net gainers or one minor contributor that is almost neutral. The Exhibit A then also shows, in the right two most columns, shows the impact of the proposed 10% cap that is proposed under Senator Limmer's bill. And in the very bottom right-hand corner, you'll note the change that under this proposed bill, you'll note the change to the fiscal disparities pool, the pool being $389 million. This change would impact the pool only by about one-half of 1%. And you can compare that one-half of 1% change to the overall pool, again, to the 20% loss of tax base that the City of Rogers has lost in recent years. A second handout, Exhibit B, is another list of cities. This is the list of, and you may have seen this from Metropolitan Council documents. It is included on their website as well in slightly different format, same list of cities. Exhibit B then is a list of the top 20 net contributors to the Metropolitan Fiscal Disparities Program. And if this was in color, you would see that the City of Rogers is shaded in blue at the very top, being the largest net contributor in that year, losing a net percentage of its tax base of almost 20%, 19.47. All other cities on this list of the top 20 net contributors are part of the regional wastewater system. They're part of the MCES, regional wastewater infrastructure. Rogers is the only city on the list of the top 20 net contributors that does not benefit from that regionally provided system. We believe these facts illustrate the need for the proposed cap under the bill in front of you today. I would note that the fact that the city is not part of the MCES system is not from lack of trying. The city has, over the past dozen or more years, attempted to become part of the metro wastewater system by having the system take over the Rogers Municipal Plant. For many reasons, timing, budget funding, and operational reasons that has not happened. Currently, the city is slated by the metropolitan system, by MCES, to be taken over in 2025. The problem with the date of 2025 and as it applies to fiscal disparities impacts here is that the Rogers plant, which we currently have approximately a $10 million value invested in the plant today, by 2020, our municipal plant is expected to need a $20 million expansion. So 5 years before being taken over by the Metropolitan Council, we would be facing a $20 million expansion. In summary, we recognize the goals of the fiscal disparities program, as Mayor Bunting mentioned, those goals being to create and maintain a strong region, but believe that the extreme impacts placed on a few communities should be moderated. The proposed legislation before you today does so by capping the tax capacity contributions of those cities that are not served by the regional infrastructure, and it does so without significant impact to the pool. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Very good testimony. Any other? Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, Mayor, why do you think the policy should hinge upon the sewage treatment system, the water treatment system? I'm wondering, we've just been talking about having a floor on LGA, making sure that smaller cities always have a base level. And I'm wondering if we couldn't put a cap on fiscal disparities so that all cities would have a reasonable cap on their fiscal disparities contribution. That would allow everybody a little more opportunity for economic development or for some differences among communities and challenges like the one that's facing Rogers.
GB, you want to take that?
Yes.
Mr. Stamer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Orman, I guess to answer that, I would say that the city, in working with Senator Limmer on this bill, we were looking to try to address the specific situations that kind of caused the issue here without significantly impacting and changing and causing too much redistribution within the pool. We believe that there is a reasonable place where a cap could be placed, whether it was hinged upon wastewater or not. But in this case, the specific impact we noted that the goals of the pool being to spread the regional costs and benefits equally just wasn't occurring in this specific case. So it was written with a specific trigger being the wastewater treatment plant. And the amendment, if I could speak to that for just a moment, the amendment changing it from being cities that were not served by regional wastewater, we changed that to reflect cities that own and operate their own wastewater treatment plant purely out of a definitional interpretation issue, so that there was no gray area when it came to implementing this by Anoka County and the state.
Senator Artin.
And I appreciate that. I'm wondering, I haven't seen that study for a while. It was presented a couple of years ago for us, the fiscal disparity study. But I'm wondering why Rogers has a very high percentage that it contributes into its market value into fiscal disparities. Where do you think that line should be drawn, whether it's for Rogers or somebody else? If 23% is too much, what should be a cap if you took out just the question of the sewage treatment or the water treatment systems?
Well, and if you to the same question, talk about what's driving that 16% number a little bit, if you would, please.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Ortman, I can first address the question about what's driving that. The city of Rogers, with a population of 11,200 now after the merger of Hasson Township and Rogers, some of you may know that the township and the city merged in January 1st of 2012. It was the remaining township in Hennepin County. So there was a consolidation of governments there and an economy scale. But at that point, we became a city of 11,200 population. The city's current tax base is comprised of approximately 55% to 56% commercial industrial property tax, with the remainder being primarily residential at about 45%. Rogers, even though we're on the fringe of the metropolitan fiscal disparities region, at the edge of Hennepin County, with cities just across the river into Wright County who are not contributing to fiscal disparities, Rogers has nevertheless been able to maintain its commercial industrial tax base, and we actually have become a net importer of jobs. Rogers has between 8,500 and 9,000 jobs within the city compared to 11,000 population. We actually have more jobs than working age adults. And the regional, again, to answer your question, Senator Ortman, with regard to what the cap might be, we didn't analyze the larger pool of what the relative impacts would be at if the entire pool were capped at 10%. I don't know how many cities would actually fall under that. My guess is there would be very few cities that are actually contributing more than 10% of their total tax capacity. And off the top of my head, it's likely to be the cities on Exhibit B that are kind of in the higher end of the cities of the largest contributors. Bloomington, Oak Park Heights would definitely fall into that range, contributing more than 10% of their total tax capacity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? We have one more testifier, Senator Limmer. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Ms. Nauman.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. And I just want to provide some very brief comments on the bill before you today, Senate File 1486. While Metro City certainly recognizes the circumstances that have brought the City of Rogers forward today with this bill, we do want to express some concerns with the sort of handling of fiscal disparities legislation in this respect. Our policies essentially state that any modifications to fiscal disparities or bills that would have impacts on fiscal disparities should really only be considered within the context of broader reform to the state's property tax, aids, and credit system. And that if you do get to that point and start looking at bills like this, that they should be considered using a criteria of equity, fairness, transparency, and stability to the current program. So again, we just offer brief comments. Metro Cities has had a longstanding policy of opposing any diversions from the pool, a fiscal disparities pool. We don't have a policy that specifically relates to this bill, but given the release of the study 2 years ago, we did undertake a pretty comprehensive review of our policy, and this is what our membership has recommended, is that we really not isolate fiscal disparities-related legislation, but consider it within a context of broader reform. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would just say I think the broader reform makes sense, that maybe we should be looking at a 15% cap. It wouldn't affect that many cities. But I hate to see it hinge on one particular aspect, and I'm wondering if Senator Limmer might comment on that.
Well, Senator Limmer. Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, the bill as it was presented to me was by the request of this one city. So I do have a limited perspective on it due to their perspective. Certainly it would have to take a broader, let's say, coalition of interest to determine if total reform would be needed. I'm unsure of how it would be applied in a broader context of a larger tax reform statewide, as Ms. Nauman has suggested. This particular city is experiencing fast growth in the last few years, and at the very same time, it doesn't get the benefit for the money that it's chipping into the program. And so if I had any type of business or anything else, I'd be concerned, too, that I'm contributing to a program maybe for the greater good, but I get nothing in return. And so I think they have a legitimate case. Whether we wait around and, you know, sometimes the state of Minnesota is a little stodgy when it comes to statewide property tax reform in light of trying to help these folks out.
Mr. Chair, I think he just called us stodgy, but
I
want to say that
Ortman.
I
was addressing my comments to Senator
it.
Ortman.
I don't accept it, and I won't return the the barb there, Senator Limmer. But I think I'm loath to do legislation that's carving out for one particular community, and I do think they have a really good point to be made. And I think this is one of the things we've been struggling with fiscal disparities as it is that we've got these communities that are contributing so much and they have disincentives for economic development because so much of their tax base goes elsewhere. And I wonder if this isn't just a great opportunity with the information in front of us to maybe look at a 15% cap. I think that would make sense because it just creates complexity in the tax code when we carve out special provisions. Any one of these cities probably could come forward and say one of the reasons their fiscal disparities payment is so high is because of X, and then we'll have the next bill in for X and then Y and then Z. And I'm wondering, let's just look at the overall policy. I think it would be a meaningful reform.
And, you know, Senator Ortman, I vaguely recall the fiscal disparity study report we had. I think you said it was 1 or 2 years ago. And I think we all thought it was disappointing that there weren't some recommendations in it.
Yeah.
I don't know if we need to go back and redo it or not. But for me, when I listen to this issue, I want to hear from Metropolitan Wastewater System and why they're waiting to 2025 to incorporate this, because that would be the resolution, in my opinion, is bring those folks in here and say, okay, we know they're going to need an upgrade. Why does that mean that they don't get to come in until 2025? So that's the folks I'd like to hear from. But Mr. Stamen, if you had something else to add.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Ortman, the points that you're making in terms of the general cap versus the wastewater treatment trigger, those were the exact debates that we were having internally in terms of developing this and in working with the senator and his staff. And one of the reasons why we did settle for discussing the bill in terms of the regional wastewater is simply that it's the primary regionally funded piece of infrastructure that can be pointed to. Roads in particular are not specifically funded at a regional level. They're typically funded by the city, county, state, and federal combination of funding mechanisms, whereas wastewater, for the most part, in the seven-county metro, it primarily is a regionally funded, except for cities like Rogers.
Mr. Chair,
Senator, I would like,
if we could do something along the lines of what you're talking about in the tax committee, I certainly would be supportive. I just don't think it's tax policy. But if you look at the city's Exhibit A, you'll see all kinds of communities in Carver County that have the same problem right along the edge of the border. They're not included in the regional district. They're having all kinds of problems related to this, and so is Scott County and those edges of the seven-county metro area. But I don't think that's tax policy. I think that's the policy for a different committee, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But sign me up if we can do it in the tax bill.
You know, we are going to look at fiscal disparities for the Iron Range, it is apparent. I don't know if I even want to start contemplating, but maybe we should look a little broader. So, anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 1486?
Nope.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I would also like to see is how this impacts. I know we've had a few fiscal disparities bills come before us, and just how would this bill impact, especially the other top few communities on, you know, Exhibit B, just to see what those shifts are. And I've had conversations with Ms. Nauman and actually Senator Russ somehow and actually Mr. Paulson on just where is the growth actually occurring and just looking at this. So I would also be interested in if we do some type of subcommittee or something, have some conversation, because, I mean, it is interesting, but just seeing how this bill would impact the other communities and their fiscal disparities in their communities, just, again, as a comparison.
And Senator Dietzick, you know, maybe we could go back and put a group together with the department and interested parties and go back and look at the study and see if there isn't some information that can be gathered there that could actually develop some recommendations. It might be something worthwhile doing.
Mr. Senator Chair, Hartman. I would be happy to participate that. I don't remember one of the recommendations being a cap. I remember, you know, repealing or a stepped approach to repealing, but I don't remember a cap, and that's why I think this is so interesting. It may give us a way to begin a reform by implementing a cap, but I would be very willing to participate in a group to look at this further.
Senator Est, I think you need to get in.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I missed the bulk of the discussion, but, you know, in the mid-'80s, we did look at a way of containing the degree to which the contribution was made. And we looked at a number of proposals then, and one of them was over a period of time reducing the contribution so that it was not it wasn't falling off a cliff. And so it was like, it took a while, but it was like over, I think, a period of 10 years or so, it was going from 40% to 38% to 36, so that the system didn't have a big fist in the face, but it recognized that perhaps too much of the of the tax base was being shared. So instead of a cap, which I think would have that effect, you know, it, within that group, which I obviously would like to participate in as well, there was just a gradual lowering of the participation, and then indeed there was also a consideration of the distribution formula as well, in terms of the money that goes back to the cities, and I think that's something that we probably should look at as too. Once again,
well, maybe we'll get a group together. I'd ask for some volunteers, mm-hmm. and we'll see what we can put together. Senator Limmer, feel welcome if you want to participate.
I'd love to, Mr. Chair.
Anything else, members? Anybody else out there? Thank you. Thank you very much. Chair lays over Senate File 1486 as amended.
Thank you,
amended
Mr. Chair, committee, and Senator
Fishman. Senator Thompson. Thank you for letting Senator Limmer go first. He can get on his way.
This one, but I didn't.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members. I'm bringing before you today file 1572, and under current law, local governments are allowed to try to work out payment plans for delinquent taxes. And what the Senate file before you would do is make some changes that would give those local governments some additional flexibility in dealing with these issues. In particular, Mr. Chairman and members, there's currently a $500,000 cap on commercial property that are subject to this particular law, and that cap would be removed so that regardless of the value of the property, local officials would be able to work with the owners of those businesses to try to work out repayment plans for commercial property. Also, secondly, this bill would permit special assessment authorities to remove all of the special assessment charges if they choose to do so and deem that's in the best interest of the local government, the taxpayer. And then also, as a part of that, would allow the taxing authority to reassess special assessments if they wish. And then finally, there's also an opportunity to require, as a condition of entering into one of these repayment plans, that environmental remediation be required to be done. And then finally, and this is not a flexibility issue, it's just a straight-up change in the law that would change the redemption period that currently on residential property is 5 years. It would change it to 3 years, which would be consistent with the redemption period on all of the other property. Now, I am unaware of any opposition to this bill. I want to make sure the committee understands that all of these things are permissive. This does not require any local government to enter into any negotiations to work out a plan. It is simply allowing them to do so and giving them a bit more flexibility. The only provision that I could imagine there could potentially be some concern with is changing the redemption period from the 5 to the 3 years on residential property. However, I have to this point heard of no opposition. I spoke with Ms. Geis, who will be testifying shortly. She has heard of no opposition. And I would also point out that this shorter redemption period could actually benefit the property owner, because if the individual is having financial difficulty, the longer it goes, the more interest and penalties that accrue. And so actually requiring them to get in and try to resolve the problem more quickly might give them a better opportunity to actually get the situation straightened out and remain in their property and work out a favorable deal with the local government. So as I indicated, I am unaware of any opposition. And Mr. Chair, I do have Cindy Geis from Scott County that is prepared to testify. So I don't know if you want to defer questions until after she's done or not. That's at the pleasure of the chair.
Mrs. Geis, I also have a Mr. Schreifels on my testimony list. Is he here?
Mr. Chair, Randy Schreifels from Stearns County could not make it today.
Oh, okay. Ms. Geis, welcome to the committee and state your name, please.
Good morning. My name is Cindy Geis. I am the Auditor Treasurer for Scott County. I am also the Minnesota Association of County Officers, MACO's co-author of the, or co-chair of the legislative committee. And I am here on behalf of MACO, the organization that deals with all of the 87 auditors and auditor treasurers of each of the counties. I'm here today because our organization has talked about some of the issues that has arrived because of the mandatory cap on commercial industrial property. And we all strive intensively to try to promote economic growth, retain jobs, as does the state of Minnesota. And so one of the problems that we've had with this is that commercial industrial properties that end up in some dire deficits and backlog of taxes and special assessments end up losing their properties because the repayment plan and the ability to enter into a plan is so restrictive. We've had cities that have approached us that have talked to us about allowing the expansion of or removing the cap of the market value cap, as well as giving them a lot of flexibility on their special assessments, since special assessments are really restricted to their improvements that they have done. The authority to do anything with a special assessment should be under their own authority if they want to remove them, reassess them, or just take them totally off base. We've had cities and properties that have gone forfeit because of this cap and because of the special assessment requirements that they pay those special assessments before they enter into a confession, if they do have the ability. And it's caused some huge disgruntlement amongst our businesses and our cities. So we're here not only on behalf of the counties, but we're here on behalf of the cities as well to open this up for conversation and consideration at your committee level. In addition, we are here to talk about the redemption period. We have had some issues with some of our residential properties, and it's really just residential homestead properties. The non-homestead property is still under the five-year redemption period, or excuse me, the three-year redemption period, but homestead properties are not. And one of the issues that we've really started to have was that our property owners have really come in some tough times, particularly in this economic environment, but they're recuperating now. And one of the things that we thought would be beneficial would be to entice them or encourage them or mandate them to have the conversation with us a little bit earlier. The interest rate on delinquent taxes is extremely high. And every year that they go delinquent is just going to add additional burden to them. So not only do they have to come up and pay with their current taxes, but they have to continue to pay on a repayment plan that sometimes is too large, and they end up losing their property. So we're trying to open that conversation, force them into having a conversation, and try to set up some type of a payment plan so that they can stay in their properties. The other issues that we're starting to see with residential properties is that these properties are, the ones that forfeit are end up being garbage houses. So not only do we have a cleanup plan now that we have to try to do something to try to mitigate what's going on those properties, that comes on the shoulders of all the taxpayers of that area as well. So when there are environmental issues with properties, whether they're commercial, industrial, or residential, and when there are problems with the residential properties not being maintained properly, this gives us another mechanism by which we can force that conversation and help them stay in their properties and clean their properties up. I would like to thank Senator Thompson for co-authoring this and thanking you for consideration of this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Geis. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I fully support this. In Minneapolis, we've had some issues. I have one house in northeast Minneapolis that the person died. It was a garbage house to begin with. The person died. The one heir lives in California. She has nothing to do with it. And there is nothing that the city can do. We have worked with the city, worked with the county. They've worked left and right looking at ways to do this. The house is slanted. It is now impacting this poor property owner next door, and that five-year window is a problem. It was originally set up. We had a lot of discussion at Hennepin County when you had people understanding forfeitures and foreclosures and the difference. And forfeitures initially were a longer time period because people – the government wanted to give people time to work out and not pay the taxes, but we are getting, I believe in Hennepin County, forfeitures are actually ticking up, and it is a lot of elderly, and the person, you know, if you have two elderly people living there and the taxpayer actually, or the person that was paying the bills dies, and so you have a person left there that is now ability to maybe live on their own, but there are no other family members around, and so I think this will help getting people in. And you know, it's unfortunate, but sometimes they do need to be forced to take some action. And then again, you have situations where that person dies and the heirs just don't want to have anything to do with it, and they won't even want to have a conversation, and they're saying, we're just going to let it go forfeit. But in that five-year time frame, that property will really, really decrease, and it is impacting the neighboring property. So I thank you for bringing this forward, and I fully support it.
Senator Artman.
And Senator Thompson, is the process for this then through the Board of Equalization and through an abatement? Or is there some other process that would be used to waive particular assessments and fees and penalties?
Ms. Geis?
Mr. Chair, Senator Artman, the process would be that we as a county would engage with the city in a conversation telling them that there is a property owner that has come forward and asking for a confession of judgment. It truly is just an administrative. A board of adjustment really works, deals solely with value, so it has nothing to do with their market value. What we would do is engage in a conversation with the municipality to ask them whether or not they wanted to consider the abatement of the special assessments. Since they are the levying authority, it would be solely up to them to abate them, to remove them, and or to add them into the confession of judgment plan. That is another option today that is not, that's another option that that is included in this, in these changes, that is not available today. Current statute requires all special assessments that are on the current tax bill, as well as all of them that are delinquent, and all the penalties and interest be paid up front before they can enter into the confession. And in many cases, that's the reason that the property is in the position that it is. The penalties and interest on the special assessments also go to the municipality. So if they choose to remove them, it's solely their budget that's affected. So it would have to be some directive that the county would receive from the council. We're asking it in the form of a resolution that their council adopt that and give the county the order to remove.
Mr. Chair, I think that answers my question. There's a public hearing involved here at the city level, so other neighbors or other taxpayers that might be affected by the decision have an opportunity to participate and testify before the city makes a decision like that and contacts the county.
Ms. Geis.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, the public hearing for abatements for property taxes or removal of special assessments generally are not held in that fashion at the city level. They do hold them in the form of the council meeting, but they don't think that there's any requirement that they send out notifications to any surrounding owners that this item is being called for consideration at that meeting.
Senator Ortman.
But it would be on a city council agenda that would be posted publicly and people could participate. That's my concern, is I want to make sure that it's consistent, that the folks that are making these decisions are accountable, and it's very public. And that, and I appreciate that. I think you've answered the question well. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else, members? Anybody else wish to testify? Seeing none. Thank you for your work, Senator Thompson. Thank you, Ms. Geis. Chair lays over Senate File 1572. Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr.
You.
Chairman and members.
Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Mr. Chair, I do have an author's amendment. Do you want to take that right away?
Senator Reinert, we'll pass the author's amendment out. There's another amendment that I'm not going to offer, but I want people to contemplate. So we'll pass them both out at the same time, and then you'll get the other amendment also.
Mr. Chair, I know time is short, so while the amendments are being passed out, I'll just give folks a broad introduction to the bill.
Senator Reinert, is this your first stop with this bill?
No.
No? Okay. Then
it's not an author's amendment.
Not an author's amendment. Okay. Let's start the testimony as the amendments come out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, this bill tries to get to the heart of it. This bill tries to get at folks that have cellular service but are not paying into the 911 fund. Those of us who have landlines are doing that. Those of us who have cell plans that we pay monthly are doing that. But we have this tertiary market of cell service that is being bought via cards, prepaid cards. It's the largest growing sector of the cell market. Those folks currently don't pay in at all for the 911 fund. And it's made for a really complicated landscape for the primary providers in Minnesota, some of whom are voluntarily collecting the fee because they think that's what they're supposed to do based on sort of the gray area of our law. Some of them are not collecting the fee. Secondary vendors, retail vendors, have actually tried submitting the fee to the state to have it sent back to them because that's not how it was viewed. So what the bill would do would be to apply 9/11 fee to prepaid cards. It would ask the Department of Revenue to administer that. And, Mr. Chair, we can either take the amendment, which is a technical one that I do support, or I can ask Mr. Murphy to speak to the bill further.
Let's do the amendment, Senator Reinhart, so the bill is in the order you'd
okay.
like.
And it's the A2 amendment. I would offer the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair, and I'll speak to it.
Could you explain?
Yeah. Could you explain the amendment, Senator
yep.
Reinhart?
So, Mr. Chair, I offer the A2 amendment. The A2 amendment is a change that takes out some legal judiciary language that has caused concerns over in the other house and with the Trial Lawyers Association. And it's been brought to me to try and keep both bills sort of in the same shape, and I'm fine with it.
Questions about the amendment, members? Seeing none, Senate Reinhart moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd ask Mr. Murphy to speak to the bill.
Mr. Murphy, mm-hmm. welcome to the Tax Committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Murphy. I represent AT&T. I just make a couple quick comments regarding the bill's background. This has been adopted in 28 other states. This is our third year in this attempt. We've had some traction, but it just never got to the finish line. It's a good proposal. It essentially addresses an issue that Senator Reinhart initially outlined, that this is something that needs to happen due to the changing market in the wireless industry. As people migrate from landline to wireless, that's kept the fund whole for a significant amount of time. But now in recent years, the growing market in the prepaid has caused a significant loss in funding to the 911 fee. So we think this addresses that. The Minnesota retailers are neutral on this bill. Retailers will retain 3% of the fee for their efforts, and revenue will retain 2% of the fee, as they will now be collecting the 911 fee that would be collected at the point of sale. I think that's essentially my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Do you want to go to the other testifier
yep.
first?
And Mr. Chair, Jamie Poole is here at the Minnesota Grocers. As Mr. Murphy said, the retailers are neutral. The grocers are not. And we've been working all the way along on this, and I welcome them to the table to talk about their concerns.
Welcome to the Tax Committee. State your name, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Jamie Poole, and I'm president of the Minnesota Grocers Association, and I'm here to speak today in opposition to Senate File 367. We are the state trade association that represents the retail food industry for over 115 years. We have over 200 retail members servicing 1,100 stores statewide, and our member companies employ over 125,000 union and non-union Minnesotans. We have a unique culture in Minnesota of small, independent, and locally owned grocery and convenience stores. They are the cornerstones of their communities. We create jobs, support local charities, and provide safe, responsible shopping experiences. We have concerns today with the bill. Today's system holds a few national carriers responsible for the collection and remittance of these 911 fees. This legislation shifts that responsibility to hundreds of local businesses selling the prepaid wireless cards on behalf of the national wireless carriers. As members of our local communities, we certainly feel strongly and we support any funding of 911 services, and certainly acknowledge the need to have mechanisms to support these programs. As the author spoke to, certainly 911 services on landlines, you pay those on your cards. The mobile phones, it's called an E911 fee, which is collected on your monthly bill. When a prepaid phone, mobile phone, or prepaid phone card is purchased, the fee is then remitted to DPS voluntarily by the national carriers. One of the concerns right now also is that there is a lawsuit going on about this question, and one concern comes that if passage of this would jeopardize that potential lawsuit for the state. This bill directly shifts all of that responsibility onto local grocers and convenience store owners. It would require each retailer to collect the 80-cent E911 fee plus the Access Minnesota fee of 6 cents. The retailer must itemize this as a separate line item on the receipt. This requires all of us to set up new point-of-sale systems. And then we all then submit the fee to the Department of Revenue, again creating a new system. We would do this in conjunction with our sales tax, which we appreciate there being consistency there, but again, it's a new line item and a new way to submit. According to the language of the bill, the departments can change the fee at any time on their website. They give us 30 days notice to the effective date of these changes, and it's our responsibility to monitor the department's website for the notice of these changes. This creates an additional burden as well and shows for potential inconsistencies in the program. This legislation does account for us to keep 3% of the combined fees for administration, which is probably 2 to 3 cents per card sold. So to put this into perspective, if a store sold one car per day for a year, their total reimbursement would be less than $9 for that 365 cards. Grocery stores and convenience stores will be most affected with additional training, consumer education, and equipment updates. We estimate that implementing for each store will cost between $500 to $2,000 to reprogram our point of sales, train our staff, and administer this new fee. Additionally, there will be ongoing administrative burdens. There are no provisions for the upfront costs within this bill. We appreciate the opportunity to sell prepaid wireless services, giving our Minnesota time-pressed families a one-stop shop. Unfortunately, the bill doesn't create a competitive disadvantage to brick-and-mortar retailers against online sales, as there is not a provision that requires the same fee structure for online. So we ask that you take this into consideration with the language of this bill. Thank you, and I'd be happy to stand for questions.
So with the new computerized cash registers that track every item in the store, you think that it would be a problem to put a line on the receipt for this item, Ms. Poole?
Mr. Chair, we would need to reprogram the point of sales. It needs to be stated separately. Obviously, once the reprogramming is done, it would be in the system, but there is a cost that will go along with that. Depending on the size of the store, whether it's a single point small convenience store, single point grocer versus a large chain, that cost will vary.
Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, this fee is already being collected and remitted at the point of sale when they sell the prepaid phone or the card.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Reinhart.
No,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Chamberlain,
Senator Reinhart. So there's no fee collected and remitted at all when they buy these prepaid phones.
Senator Reiner.
Mr. Chair. So, Senator Chamberlain, part of the problem we're trying to address is that some of the major carriers, if they sell their own, are collecting and submitting the fee. Others are not. But in the third-party vendors, it's not being collected at all. In fact, in Minnesota, we had the situation where Walmart tried to send the fee into the state and had the fee returned because it's unclear in state law how this should be handled.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Chamberlain,
follow up. So, would we be able to correct this if we simply required? I mean, if we language that said you had to, at the point of sale, Walmart say they sell these prepaid phones or these cards, say you collect it then and then remit it, and the state then keep that money. I mean, wouldn't that be a little bit simpler? I know that there are costs involved in this setting these things up. I know you appreciate this, Senator Reinhart, but having worked in the different aspects in the private sector, even changing one, a lot of people sit out here and say, well, we'll just require them to put this little box in this form and remit it. Well, that can generate 2 years, a project that takes 2 years, depending on the size of the organization, take 2 years and maybe $1 million or more. So I'm sympathetic to that, and if we can get this done in the simplest manner with the least harm to people, that would be preferable. I understand what you're trying to do and make it equitable, but I would think maybe there's an easier way to do it.
And Mr. Chair, just to quickly address Senator Chamberlain's point, I think you dove right to the heart of this kind of last remaining issue. I think without speaking for the grocers, they would say we'd like to try and figure out a way to kind of recoup these additional costs we might have up front. versus over the lifetime that we might carry this product. The other side would say, well, you don't have to carry the product, so if it's a cost you don't want to incur, just don't carry it. The grocers would say it's a convenience for our customers, and in the small shops especially, it helps bring people in the door. You know, in full disclosure, the Department of Revenue would say we don't really want to do this either. You know, but at the end of the day, the folks, especially our law enforcement folks that benefit from the 911 system, you know, would note that this is the fastest growing sector of the cell market, and we're inconsistent on how we collect it, and in most cases we're just not collecting it at all. So, you know, I wish we could present you a perfect solution, but from the matrix of the 25 or 26 states that have adopted it, you'll see that we're sort of right in the sweet spot of where we're at nationally, and I think we are sort of at a place where there probably isn't a better or more perfect solution we can prevent, but I'm certainly amenable.
Mr. Chair, just one
Senator
final.
Chamberlain.
Sorry, thank you. I should have thought about this earlier. Going back to need, is the fund falling short? And do we need the extra money at this time to keep the 911 system and TAMS running? Are we running out of money? So is there a need for the extra money? I could guess the answer, but I'll ask.
Mr. Chair, I'll let Mr. Murphy make some comments, but in short, Senator Chamberlain, yes. Especially, is it falling short on a day-to-day cash basis? No. But are we falling short on reinvesting in the infrastructure of the system? Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Murphy.
Senator Chamberlain, I don't pretend to speak for the Department of Public Safety, but in conjunction and in partnership with Public Safety, we have begun to go down what's called the next-gen 911 street, where they will be upgrading the entire system to voice over internet protocol, be text 911, and other innovations that will cost the system a significant amount of money. We anticipate that those discussions are going on right now with the FCC, and we anticipate that to DPS to be coming to the legislature in a couple years to institute that, and that will cost significant money right at about the same time that this money should be starting to come in from the prepaid.
Senator Chamberlain?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, just another concern. I'm concerned about the grocers and the costs that it is to implement this program, but I'm also concerned about the regressive nature of this. I mean, who's buying these prepaid phone cards? It's the elderly, it's the students, it's the poorer and lower income folks in our communities that are buying these prepaid phone cards. And I just have to say that is of concern to me. I see the merits of doing it, to making it consistent for all 911 users and all cell phones. I get that. Just a little concerned about that. And I'm not sure how we resolve that or how we resolve the concerns, the valid concerns of the grocers. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, I know Mr. Murphy wants to make some comments. The heart of this is the equity issue, and I would suggest to you, Senator, that that's where prepaid started. It's not where prepaid is at now. Prepaid now is with people who just don't want the contract. You know, it's a lot of young professionals that are doing it. It doesn't negate the regressive question, and there's some parameters in the bill that try to help with that.
So, members, we're in session at 11, so we're drawing near, and I really wanted to just have a minute for you to look at the A3 amendment, and I wanted to have the opportunity to say, you know, we have struggled with these sales tax exemptions on these armor grants. Some counties have gotten them, some haven't. Some counties have gotten grants from the federal government to pay for their armor systems. Some have gotten state grants to pay for their armor systems. Some have not received any grants or any sales tax exemptions. So I wanted the committee to contemplate perhaps taking some of the revenues from this fund, because this is public safety communications also, and see if we should try to address some of those jurisdictions that paid the sales tax, didn't receive any state or federal grants, and help them with their costs. And so if members would be willing to take a look at the A3 amendment and
when we're putting our bill together, this will probably come back before us if we're doing any work in this area. So, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not to the A3 amendment.
No.
Okay. I'll just be real brief, and I can visit with Senator Reinert offline if necessary. I understand the concern and the undue burden I think it puts on the grocers to have to go out and monitor a website to see if there's a change in the fee. And I would hope that there's some way we can massage this bill or amend this bill so that, obviously, it seems to me that the Department of Public Safety would have the ability to send out a notice or an email when they change their fee. I don't think that's asking too much. And so I think we'd certainly have the technology to do that.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator, they don't that fee is not changed on a regular basis. I don't believe it's been changed in 2 or 3 years. It's a floating fee, but it does it's not changed on a regular basis, but we have had discussions with the department about that.
One more.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Yes, thank you. So my concern is just that I don't think it is reasonable to tell any business they have to go out and monitor a website to see when something is changed and now they're supposed to comply with it. So I don't care if it's changed every week or every 3 years. I just don't think the businesses should have to go monitor every day to see when we in the state of Minnesota change our policies, and I would think we'd have the technology to eliminate that.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, I wanted to inquire about, I mean, like in my household, we have a landline and 4 cell phones. So I'm wondering if in somehow that isn't balanced out, because we're probably, I mean, and all the cell phones are not prepaid. So I'm thinking we're paying 5 times that. And I would think that I'm not the only one who has that situation. I would think that somehow this is being balanced out. Just a question.
Anything else, Senator Reinert?
No, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, and I'll just be quick. I'm sitting here listening, and I'm wondering whether or not, you know, I think I was involved with Senator Random when we did this initially. I'm wondering what a good idea might have been in 2003 or 4 may not be a good idea anymore. Maybe we should find a different funding source.
Not use the cell phone fee at all? That would be novel.
I'm not going to do that.
I think Senator Sendrum will think about that, too. anything else, members? We are meeting tomorrow morning
right.
At 10:30, 8:30. Do we have an agenda?
I probably have to. Yeah.
My husband has 2.
The agenda is posted. I apologize for not having it for you.
Mr. Chair, for clarity, you're going to lay this bill over.
I'm laying it over. Chair lays over Senate File 367 as amended for possible inclusion. Thanks, Senator Reinert. Members, we'll see you tomorrow morning.
So we're committee's adjourned. I mean,